Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
And a warm welcome to Monday. This is DW's Africa Link coming to you live from Bonn in Germany. My name is Abubakar Jallo.
And I'm your co-host, Crispin Mwakideo, with what's trending on social media.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, the Gambia's Yahya Jammeh is out of office, but so did $11 million. The incoming government has accused the former leader of emptying the state's coffer before his departure.
I just gave an indication of having reckless spending and fiscal impropriety of the former president, that if he could withdraw 500 million within a period of 2 weeks, that is the height of irresponsibility.
And the Syrian government and rebel factions are meeting in Kazakhstan on a renewed attempt to bring peace to the war-torn nation.
The organizers have been trying to keep expectations down. They say this is only about shoring up the ceasefire that already exists in Syria, maybe extending it a bit and maybe bringing in some humanitarian initiative.
And on social media, we bring you the reaction to the developing story in the Gambia.
Hope you'll stick around for these stories and more. First, a look at what's happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Speaking in neighboring Senegal, newly elected Gambian President Adama Barrow has said he would soon return to the small West African country, where exiled ruler Yahya Jammeh has reportedly drained the state coffers. Barrow's special advisor said the Gambia is in financial distress after Jammeh allegedly stole millions of dollars in his final weeks in power before fleeing to Equatorial Guinea.
The Gambia, economically, is in financial distress. The coffers are virtually empty. That is a state of fact. This has been affirmed by the technicians at the Ministry of Finance and the Central Bank of the Gambia.
Meanwhile, opposition members in Equatorial Guinea have denounced the government's decision to welcome the exiled ex-president. The Democratic Opposition Front said Jammeh should not qualify for political asylum, as he triggered a crisis in the Gambia by refusing to step down after losing the December vote to Barrow. Jammeh had ruled the Gambia for over 20 years and could face prosecution for corruption and human rights abuses. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier has commented on U.S. President Donald Trump's inauguration speech, saying to reporters in Berlin on Monday that it lacked clarity on his administration's domestic and foreign policy. Steinmeier also spoke on the apparent deep division in the U.S., saying that the mass weekend protests indicate that much is to be done for the U.S. to unite behind the president.
The clashes on the streets and the demonstrations for and against the new administration indicate that a lot of work is still needed for this country to be united behind the president. That will take priority for now, and I believe only then will the administration make a declaration on NATO and Europe.
In Germany, police have said they arrested a terror suspect accused of planting a bomb aimed at killing police and soldiers in the country. Authorities said the 21-year-old man was allegedly linked to an Austrian teenager who was arrested in Vienna on Friday for also planning a terror attack. German politician Ralf Jäger said the arrest of the man shows that security forces are cooperating well to fight against terrorism in Europe. Syrian peace talks have begun in Kazakhstan on Monday in a renewed push to end the six-year conflict. Rebel parties, however, have confirmed they would not meet face-to-face with the Syrian government during the first session of negotiations. Russia, Turkey, and Iran have sponsored the talks, which come a month after the regime captured rebel-held areas of Aleppo, where fierce fighting between warring sides killed thousands of people. And now in sports, host Gabon failed to advance in the African Cup of Nations after a scoreless draw with Cameroon on Sunday. Gabon has lost in the group stage in two straight tournaments, while Cameroon has advanced to the semifinals for the first time in 7 years. Sunday's other game saw Burkina Faso defeat Guinea-Bissau 2-0. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
I'm Abubakar Jallo, and now let's begin in the Gambia, where the incoming government has accused defeated leader Yahya Jammeh of plundering the state's coffers in the final week of his departure. Mai Fati, a top aide to President Adama Barrow, said the new administration discovered that some $11 million had recently been stolen. Take a listen to what Fati said in a press conference on Sunday.
The Gambia, economically, is in financial distress. The coffers are virtually empty. That is a state of fact. This has been affirmed by the technicians at the Ministry of Finance and the Central Bank of the Gambia. I just gave an indication of the reckless spending and fiscal impropriety of the former president, that if you could withdraw 500 million within a period of 2 weeks, when the government was moribund, there was no activities going on, no investment in social services, it's just indiscriminate order to the Central Bank to release that amount of money. That is the height of irresponsibility. The Gambia is very poor. We have serious problems.
Now, so far, these are accusations, of course, but how true can they be? A question I put to Peter Penner, a researcher at the Michigan State University with specific interest in power transitions and regional organizations.
That accusation is definitely a possibility at this point. And we've actually seen this happen in power transitions in a number of other settings. So recently, the power transition a few years ago in Tunisia, where Ben Ali left for exile. He left with quite a lot of the state resources in his departure. And even before that, in Nigeria, Sani Abacha did a similar thing, looting the country, they estimate, between $1 to $5 billion. So we've seen this in a number of similar cases to the Gambia. And the fact that the Gambia was essentially run for the last 22 years as essentially a fiefdom under Yahya Jammeh, it's quite possible that he had access to those resources and could easily transport them.
Do you believe that Jammeh should be held responsible for some of those crimes committed in his 20-year reign and also for this amount of money, this $11 million that he stole from the state coffers?
I think for many Gambians, they're talking on social media and those that I've reached out to suggest that he should be held accountable in some form, both for the money and some of the abuses that have happened in the past.
Do you think if Yahya Jammeh is held responsible for his crimes, do you think that would deter other dictators from also making way for elected officials?
I think it deters perhaps some leaders from doing similar things in similar environments, but probably not many. And the reason is that ECOWAS played a very important role in this power transition. And I think as an analyst and as a researcher who looks at regional bodies in comparative perspective, I would suggest that this power transition in the Gambia probably would not have happened if it happened in, say, East Africa, in the East African community context, or in Central Africa, in where there's the economic community of Central African states. And that's because these regional bodies don't hold their leaders to account in the way that they did in the Gambia. So that international component was very important.
That was Peter Pena, a researcher at the Michigan State University, talking about the situation in the Gambia.
And it's very interesting, Abu, that in the Gambia, one man leaves and then thousands of others return. I mean, tens of thousands of Gambians had fled the Gambia to neighboring countries, particularly Senegal.
But since Jammeh's departure, actually, hundreds have been seen crossing the ferry back to the Gambia.
That's right. And on our DW Africa Facebook page, we have posted several articles on this fast developing story. And in one of the articles, we asked the question, should Jammeh be prosecuted for his rule in the Gambia? Muhammad Drame said Jammeh shouldn't have been allowed to leave the country in the first place. He should face justice for the killings, rapes, tortures, lootings, armed trafficking, drug trafficking that he has committed.
Well, that's of course his opinion, and we should note that if he is not found guilty, we should just consider Jammeh to be still innocent.
Well, that's correct, Abu. Another user said President Barrow should be careful. He should not try to create conflict, but rather move on with the Gambia. He should not be influenced by the Western media, and he shouldn't think it's all over. Gambians must try to reconcile and forgive each other and forget the past.
Thanks, Crispin. Burundi's Minister of Justice today launched an operation to release about 2,500 inmates serving prison terms of below 5 years. Justice Minister Amy Laurentine Kanyama said it's a presidential pardon targeting mostly those that participated in protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza's third term bid in April 2015. From Bujumbura, Apollinaire Nyirora sent this report.
About 300 inmates have been released today following a presidential pardon announced by President Pierre Nkurunziza in the New Year message. Justice Minister Emero Rantine Kanyana said the released prisoners include 58 politicians who were jailed for clashing with police in March 2014 at the MSD party office in the Burundian capital Bujumbura. The government will also release some of the opposition members who participated in the protests against President Nkurunziza's third-term bid, which he went on to win in July 2015. A member of the MSD, an opposition party, who was released, thanked the government for setting him free, but called for the release of other MSD members who were jailed during the clashes with the police on the 8th of March 2014, as they resisted the arrest of MSD chairman Alexis Nduhije at a meeting. The pardon targets inmates whose jail sentences were less than 5 years or who have already spent three quarters of their jail terms.
Apollinaire Nirora reporting from Bujumbura. Fresh peace talks aimed at solving serious long-running conflict are underway in the Kazakh capital Astana. Members of the Syrian government have been meeting with opposition groups for the first time in a year. The talks have been jointly sponsored by key players in Syria's war, that's Russia and Iran, which back the government, and Turkey, which supports the rebels. TW correspondent Nick Connolly is following the talks in Astana, and he joins me now. Nick, how have the talks been going on so far?
We understand they haven't met face-to-face, that is, the Syrian government and the opposition, as had been hoped. They only sat together for the opening statement, and after that we went back to what we've had at previous talks on Syria, which is so-called proximity talks, where you have the two delegations in separate rooms and diplomats shuttling between the two rooms, mediating. The organizers have been trying to keep expectations down. They say this is only about shoring up the ceasefire that already exists in Syria, maybe extending it a bit and maybe bringing in some humanitarian initiatives. But even by those very modest hopes, it seems things aren't going very well here.
You just said that the two factions or the two sides have not been able to meet face-to-face. And we understand that the rebel did insist that they did not want to have a face-to-face conversation with the government. Do they maintain this position?
So far, yes. They've complained about the Syrian government infringing the truce on the ground in Syria. They said they're not happy at the level of Iranian influence in all of these talks. They don't want the Iranians to figure in any final declaration. But neither of those two factors are new. So it's not really very easy to understand how they've come to this decision.
Russia is mediating this talk, and it is pretty clear that Russia is taking sides in this whole conflict in Syria. Isn't that a bit ironic?
Well, sure, that is clear that obviously Russia is not an independent arbiter in that sense. But you do have Turkey here, which has supported the opposition against President Assad throughout the conflict. And I think that it's that relationship and the fact that you have this closening of ties between Russia and Turkey, and they're both here, that's what's made these talks possible in the first place. Had it only been Russia and Iran who have been behind Assad for all this time, then I can't see how the opposition would have made their way here, what they would have talked about. But given that we've had this extraordinary rapprochement between Ankara and Moscow in the last few months, that's really the thing that's made the difference and that's brought in that Turkish credibility and those links to the opposition and made this possible.
The US is a notable absentee from these negotiations. Do we know why they are not participating?
Well, they do have their ambassador here, but he is only an observer. That's true. You'll remember that the new administration of Donald Trump was invited by Moscow, and the Turks were also very keen for them to come. It was seen in Russia as an olive branch to the new administration after pretty atrocious ties to the outgoing Obama team. There's lots of head scratching here as to why they haven't come.
DW's Nick Connolly in Kazakhstan.
Abu, let's return to our main story, which is the Gambia. And our Facebook users have been posting messages following revelations that former President Yahya Jammeh emptied the treasury before his departure. David Reginald Tarimo commented, "African dictators are always ruling their countries like family property. Mr. Barrow, it's better to start over than trying to find the mistake for Jammeh. It's too late." Another comment is from Peter Small, and he says, "Adama Barrow will not bring anything good for the Gambia. He will spend his time chasing after Jammeh. That's African leadership." And talking of African leadership, Yunus Abbas Ibrahim commented, "I don't understand African governments. When they take over, immediately they say no money, but quickly you see the new government buying new cars and showing off."
Well, thanks everyone for your contributions. Keep the conversations going on our Facebook page, DW Africa. You are listening to DW's Africa Link from Bonn in Germany with me, Abubakar Jallo.
And Crispin Mwakideu.
And in the next 15 minutes, Zimbabwe reports an outbreak of armyworms.
I would want to tell the minister to control the worm. They shouldn't take it for granted. It will actually reduce our national yield. Armyworm has been a problem this season in my maize crop.
And the hashtag Alternative Facts has taken Twitter by storm. We find out why and what people are saying about it.
Interesting there. But first in Zimbabwe, after 2 years of drought, the rains are pouring again. But an outbreak of armyworms is now threatening crops, especially maize, the country's staple food. As DW's Columbus Mavunga reports from the capital Harare, the United Nations says the problem is also in Zambia and in Malawi.
Incessant rains pounding in most parts of Zimbabwe had raised hope that hunger might ease. But with the current outbreak of armyworm, the situation might get worse. Tatenda Mapfumo is a farmer in Mazoe district, about 60 kilometers north of Harare, one of the most affected areas by armyworm. He appeals to the government and fellow farmers to fight armyworm targeting his maize crop.
I would want to tell the minister to control the worm. They shouldn't take it for granted. It will actually reduce our national yield. Armyworm has been a problem this season in my maize crop. It has really been affecting the crop. In a way to try and control it, we started spraying this past week, about a week ago, and we're now starting to see the results. Yeah, I'm sure we'll be able to beat the worm, though it's been really a challenge. We have to use extra resources we didn't plan for to control the worm, so it's been a challenge for us.
The challenge he refers to is lack of financial muscle to buy pesticides to fight the outbreak. However, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, says it will ensure that the problem of armyworm would not drastically impact on the food insecurity already affecting the region due to the 2015-2016 drought induced by El Nino weather phenomenon. Chimimba David Piri is the FAO head for Southern Africa.
We have provided them with tools and equipment to ensure that they can monitor throughout the year the possible spread of armyworm. Important also is that communities and farmers that first notice something strange, they should report so that action can be taken as quickly as possible. Otherwise, there's contagion spreading from farm to farm and eventually from country to country.
What is worrying FAO is an outbreak in Zimbabwe of an armyworm type called 4, which Piri said until now it had only been seen in Nigeria in the whole of Africa.
Problem with the 4 armyworm is that it is not easily controllable with chemicals. Unless it has been identified in a farm at a very early stage, it has many cycles, and if it is not controlled at a time when it's laying eggs, then if it goes into the stem of the usually the maize crop or other cereals, then it becomes very difficult to control.
Some experts say the 4 armyworm might have come into Zimbabwe through imports of food from other parts of the world. For years now, Zimbabwe, once the breadbasket of Southern Africa, largely depends on food assistance due to drought coupled with a chaotic land reform program that displaced white commercial farmers of their land. FAO says about 5 million people need food assistance in Zimbabwe until about March when harvesting starts. But with the armyworm, it might be longer.
DW's Columbus Mavunga reporting from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Health check.
The World Health Organization wants to eliminate malaria in at least 35 countries by 2030. Although there has been a lot of progress towards this goal, some countries recently have noted that case numbers are remaining constant or even rising. At Ifakara Health Institute in Tanzania, scientists believe that one of the reasons behind this is a shift in the mosquito population which transmits the disease. The mosquitoes are biting people outside at times when they used to feel safe. This report by Julia Gross is now presented by Neil King.
The sun is beginning to set in Ifakara, a town of 60,000 inhabitants at the heart of Tanzania. Like every day here, dozens of children and young men have gathered to play football on a dusty pitch. Tanzania, and especially Ifakara, have come a long way in battling this deadly disease. One meaning of the name Ifakara is the place where you go to die. Today, the average number of infectious mosquito bites in Ifakara is down to just 18 per year, thanks to the use of insecticide-treated bed nets and indoor residual spraying. Tanzania, as a whole, has reduced malaria transmission by 60%. Despite this success, the disease is not gone, says Salum Mapuya, a young scientist working at Ifakara Health Institute.
Mosquitoes have gotten a little bit smarter, so they try to feed increasingly outdoors, especially early evening, the time that most of the people outside are doing several activities like cooking and storytelling and others.
It seems that since most people are protected under bed nets when they are sleeping, there has been a shift in the population, as well as in the behaviour of the mosquitoes. Hamis Chande, a farmer from Ifakara, is sitting in front of his house under a mosquito net with a simple trap attached to it.
I have four children and all of them have contracted malaria. I fed it myself too, four or five times. It's very hard for me because I don't have a lot of money. And when I get malaria, I have to look for a little bit of money to buy drugs. If I can, I buy the cheap drugs for between 3,000 and 5,000 shillings. That's between $1 and $2. The really good drugs are more expensive though, between 10,000 and 20,000 shillings. That's about $5 to $10. But if I'm very sick and have to be admitted to hospital, it's very expensive.
We are on a ferry crossing the Kilombero River just south of Ifakara, a village called Lupiro, a few kilometers down a dirt road on the other side of the river, is one of the testing grounds for the researchers from Ifakara Health Institute.
So me and my colleagues have thought about what if we develop something that can cover that gap of outdoor malaria transmissions and outdoor biting. So we came up with this trap called mosquito landing box.
Salum Mapuya guides me to a big black wooden box standing next to a hut in the village. It resembles a beehive, but the sides have openings like a window shutter.
So the box has two components. It has a component that lures mosquito towards it, and the other component, it's a killing component. So we came up with this idea of using electrocuting grids. So which is non-chemical technology.
In a previous study inside Ifakara Health Institute's large tent testing facilities, the landing boxes reduced the number of malaria mosquitoes attempting to bite humans by a factor of four. But when they took the first three mosquito traps to Lupiro, the scientists figured out the boxes could bring another benefit to the people in the village, light.
That report was by Julia Gross and presented by Neil King. And for some sports update now on the ongoing Africa Cup of Nations, AFCON, and the German Bundesliga, Chok Menfold from our sports desk joins us now in the studio. Chok, host nation of AFCON tournament is out, Gabon. Does that come as a shock to you?
No, it's not a shock to me. I mean, they're not one of the really big African countries in terms of football. There had been some hope that they, you know, being the host nation, they'd have an advantage, but they only tied all three games. This is good news for Dortmund here in Germany because it means Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang will be coming back a little earlier than they had feared, and they could do with him. They had some trouble with Werder Bremen, 10 men Werder Bremen on the weekend, so they need his goal scoring. Of course, he's the top scorer in the league. He's partly at fault maybe for Gabon not advancing because he had a great opportunity early in the game to score, and he missed.
Speaking about the Bundesliga and AFCON here, about this, the two relations here, Dortmund hasn't been the only team to suffer from this ongoing AFCON. I understand Schalke as well.
Yeah, Schalke, I think, are really upset about the African Cup of Nations because they actually lost three players, Nabil Bentaleb, Bernard Tekpete, and Abdul Baba Rahman. The sporting director, Christian Heidel, has complained about this a couple of times. Actually, Baba, as he's known, Abdul Baba Rahman, has come back from the African Cup of Nations with an injury. It looks like it's going to be long-term, a knee injury. And They also had some question on the weekend about whether they would be allowed to play Choping Moteng because he had been picked by Cameroon, although he refused to go, but he was able to play on Saturday. So Schalke's not a big fan of the Africa Cup of Nations.
Okay, and more about the Bundesliga. Eintracht Frankfurt did make a formidable comeback, didn't they?
Well, they had a great start to the season, but then they and this was actually the last game of the second or the first round of the season. Things were all over for them in Leipzig very early in that match, as their goalkeeper, who's been really solid all season, came way out of his area to play a ball, and he played the ball with his hands, so he was sent off very early, and that just set up Frankfurt for a 3-0 drubbing against Leipzig. Leipzig, though, keeping the pace, and we'll see how they do in the second half.
And what about top team of the Bundesliga, Bayern? How has they been faring so far?
Yeah, well, Bayern, they ended the first round, the first half of the season with a 2-1 win over Freiburg. But like the first half of the season all along, it seems like they weren't quite firing on all cylinders. Freiburg went up very early in the match, and it took Bayern a little while to tie it up. And they only won the match with a Lewandowski strike very late in the game. So Freiburg, a lot of people thought, were unlucky to not get a tie from it. But the important thing is Bayern got the 3 points and stayed top of the table.
RB Leipzig, they did... I see the incredible coming into the Bundesliga. So how far have they been doing so far?
Well, they're second in the league. They even took over the top of the table for a short time until the last game of last year, when they got beat pretty handily by Bayern. They've been the big surprise of the league, and this was, of course, the end of the first half of the season. We'll see how the start of the second half the coming weekend goes, but there's no reason to think that they won't at least finish in Europe this year.
DW Sports guru, Chuck Penfold, thank you.
And Abu, the newly inaugurated US President Donald Trump has hit out at the media for reporting that former President Barack Obama's inauguration in 2009 drew a larger crowd than his inauguration on Friday. Many news outlets showed pictures depicting the two inaugurations, and it is clear from the pictures at least that in 2009 there were more people. Anyway, Kellyanne Conway, one of Trump's senior advisors, said in an interview with NBC Network that the White House had alternative facts to what the media was reporting.
That's quite interesting. Yeah, alternative facts. Okay, I always thought a fact is a fact.
Well, think again, Abu. Anyway, the hashtag alternative facts has been trending on Twitter since she made those remarks, and here's a sample of some of the tweets. Jonathan Riley commented, "Kellyanne's alternative facts comment is revealing. This administration does not believe in truth. To them, whoever yells louder is right." And Full Frontal tweeted, "Hillary is president right now. I choose to believe this. Hashtag alternative facts." And then comedian D.L. Hughley also tweeted, "All I know is if you give alternative facts on the witness stand, you're," and I wouldn't use the word, "is catching a case." Kyla Salgado also tweeted, "If you fail a test, just explain to the teacher that you used or hashtag alternative facts."
Okay, I mean, we are laughing about this, so we're bringing humor in this. But to be honest, there's a lot of humor. I'm not sure how serious we should take this. It's a question of credibility for the new administration. What are Trump supporters saying?
Well, indeed, Abu, it's a very, very serious issue. And this discussion has raised also the question of whether we are now living in the post-truth era. Anyway, let's move on to another story. Local celebrity Somizi Mlongo in South Africa sent Twitter a buzz after he posted on Instagram that he stormed out of a church after Ghanaian-born Bishop Doug Hayward Mills made homophobic comments. And since Sunday, the hashtag Grace Bible Church has been trending in South Africa. There's one Twitter user who goes by the name Kolofelo Matsaung, and he tweeted, "Dear gay community, people, you don't see fornicators and thieves and people who committed adultery storm out of the church." And Kevin Tafadzwa Snake also tweeted, "People nowadays want to go to church to hear what they want, not what God says, and it's very wrong." And then we had 2017 Africa, who tweeted, "Can South Africa have its first own gay church this year?" And last but not least, The Hand of SARS also tweeted, "It's just funny that the only rule modern Christians follow is the homosexual rule, but they ignore fornication."
Thank you, Crispin. And that's all we had time for. For more stories, visit our website, dwafrica.com/Africa.
Or you can keep the conversation going on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
From me, Abubakar Jallo.
And Crispin Wakideu.
Have a wonderful day.